This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the TriDot Podcast. I have been looking forward to this podcast topic for a very long time. Today, we are going to be talking about bone health for endurance athletes, and we have with us two outstanding guests. I am pleased to introduce you to Dr. Jillian Wooldridge. Jillian is a primary care sports medicine physician working with Houston Methodist. She is a team physician for Rice University and is on teaching faculty in the Texas A&M Engineering Medicine Program. Dr. Wooldridge also serves on the Rodeo Sports Medicine Committee, and she is a consultant for the Houston Ballet. Her expertise lies in osteoporosis and bone health, and she is part of the International Society for Clinical Densitometry and member of the teaching faculty for the Osteoporosis Essentials course. Jillian, welcome to the TriDot Podcast.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here and happy to help share some information on bone health for your listeners.
We are also welcoming back Dr. Krista Austin. Dr. Austin is an exercise physiologist and nutritionist who consulted with the U.S. Olympic Committee and the English Institute of Sport. She has a PhD in exercise physiology and sports nutrition, a master's degree in exercise physiology, and is a certified strength and conditioning specialist. It's nice to be on the show with you again, Krista.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to having a great conversation on a really important topic.
Me too. And I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. We're going to start off as usual with the warm-up question, move into the main set, and then we'll cool down with our coach cool down tip. It's going to be a great set today, everybody. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
For our warm-up question, I want to know your most comical, memorable, or embarrassing injury story. Jillian, let's start with you.
Sure. So I have something that happened relatively recently. Back in January, I was skiing for the second time ever in my life in Vail, Colorado. And I was tired and should have taken a break, but I didn't. I was wanting to push through. And I had the least dramatic fall in skiing history ever. It would never have made any sort of news story, but I managed to tear my ACL. And that's not even the most dramatic part of it. So it was unfortunate. I had this little fall, felt a pop. I knew exactly what I had done. But I was on this very steep part at the very, very top of Vail Mountain, which if you're not familiar, it's a gigantic mountain. And a very kind gentleman stopped and asked me if I was okay. I said, no, I was not. He asked me if I could get down the slope. I said, no, I cannot. And then he asked if I would like to have ski patrol come get me. And I said, yes, I would. And so they had to strap me into that little coffin thingy where you're like wrapped up. And it was the very top of the mountain. So I was like snowmobiled and drugged down. And it took like 20 minutes because we're at the very top of the mountain. I'm wearing bright pink because I always wanted to be able to be spotted easily by rescuers. So it was a little bit embarrassing.
Yeah, that, you know what is the craziest thing about those little toboggans that they use or the sleds is that they go so fast down the hill. Was it like the fastest sled ride of your life?
It very much felt that way. And they hadn't had snow in about 10 days. So it was a little rough. So at one part I had to like lift my head up because it was bumping against the back and I really didn't want a concussion on top of my torn ACL.
So, yeah, right.
Yeah, it was an interesting
story. Well, I'm sorry to hear that you're in recovery mode right now. Krista, what about you? Do you have any crazy injury stories for us?
Well, you know, I haven't had many injuries. So for me, I would tell you the story about my right shoulder. I had been preparing to actually follow through Ranger School, Army Ranger School, the first group of women that would be going through. And I've been doing a lot of training just with a ruck on my back, running with it, you know, on your back, because that's kind of part of what they do. And then found out I wasn't going. So I decided to treat myself to a massage. And after the massage, I came back to my parents' house and noticed that the dog's favorite toy was over the fence in the neighbor's yard, and was very used to going and getting the dog's toy from the neighbor's yard. So there was a fence, and I popped over it like I usually do. But unfortunately, this time it wasn't clear. There was a pile of Spanish tiles on the other side of the wall, and it caused me to go spilling into a brick wall when I hopped over that tore my right labrum and broke the bone that helps hold the humeral head in. So I had to actually pull myself back over the fence and drive to the ER, and they said I was very stoic. But that's probably about as exciting as I get. It's not total embarrassment, but I did have to go back to work that way with a whole bunch of recon Marines. And in the Marine Corps, you know, any sign of weakness, right, they kind of take advantage of. So have had my fun, I guess, with injuries, but nothing ever too serious. So I guess I'm pretty fortunate in that regard. But there's my fun, embarrassing story. I don't know how embarrassing it truly is, but
my injury story most definitely falls into the embarrassing category. I'm redheaded. I am left-handed. And apparently those two things are not a good combination for staying on your feet. So the one thing, I've only shared this story with friends up to this point. And when I told Andrew about this experience a while ago, he immediately said, this story must end up on the podcast someday. So the day has come, everybody. I hope you enjoy it. I'm getting a little bit vulnerable here, but I was an awkward 14-year-old. I was practicing the piano. I was home alone. And my dog was like the most precious thing to me at this point in my life. And his name was Waldo. And he came up behind me as I was playing on the piano. And I adored him so much that I stopped playing and I leaned back off of the piano bench to pet him. And then this one had happened. I ended up falling off the piano bench backwards in a very enthusiastic way, of course. That's part of my nature. And somehow the piano bench landed on top of me. And it was one of those benches that opens so you could store like your books inside. And so it landed on top of me. And when it opened so hard right onto my nose. And I don't know how I defied the laws of physics in this situation, but it opened onto my nose. I got up, I was crying. My nose was bleeding. I ended up with like fully broken nose and very black eyes and a very bruised ego as a result. So that's my embarrassing story. Well, let's throw this out to the wild. Make sure you're a part of the I Am Triadot Facebook community. And I'm actually going to be posting this very question. I'm looking forward to reading the comments and hearing about your most comical, embarrassing, or memorable injury story. So make sure you're a part of that group so we can share the love.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Before we get too deep into the show today, I want to give a shout out to our good friends at UCAN. Here at Tridot, we are huge believers in using UCAN to fuel our training and racing. In the crowded field of nutrition companies, what separates UCAN from the pack is the science behind Live Steady, the key ingredient in UCAN products. While most energy powders are filled with sugar or stimulants that cause a spike and crash, UCAN energy powders, powered by Live Steady, deliver a steady release of complex carbs to give you stable blood sugar and provide long-lasting energy. I am so excited to get my shipment of UCAN products. Their energy bars are out of this world. Between their energy mix, energy bars, almond butter, and more, there is definitely a Live Steady product that you will love. So head over to their website, ucan.co, that's UCAN.co, and use the code TRIDOT to save 20% on your entire order. It used to be 10%, but the fine folks at UCAN have upped it to 20% off for TRIDOT Nation. So once again, that's UCAN.co, promo code TRIDOT. As endurance athletes, we are often preoccupied with our training schedules, how we're going to balance it all along with family, social life, work, fueling ourselves before, during, and after sessions, and the list just goes on. There is a lot to think about. But have you ever thought of this pretty important thing that supports us the whole way through, something that we probably don't pay attention to unless something goes wrong? What I'm talking about is our skeleton. It is the reason we can actually move our bodies for the fun training that we get to do. And unless we have broken it in some way, we most likely neglect it. So today, let's shine the spotlight on our unsung hero and find ways to keep it healthy and working for us instead of hindering our progress and our race dreams and goals. So, Dr. Woldridge, I would love to know what sparked your interest in working in this particular field of sports medicine.
So for sports med, kind of as a whole, my journey probably starts like a lot of my sports medicine colleagues, where I was an athlete. I did all sorts of ball sports that I was not very good at, but really my primary sport was cheerleading. So I cheered in high school and college. I actually am a rice alum, so I cheered there. And I had no business being an athlete. I was the human version of a lemon, you know, like a car that keeps breaking down. So that was me. Just various overuse injuries. And so I was practically living in the training room, just trying to be able to keep, you know, tumbling and stunting. And I started wondering, well, wait, why am I doing this? And what does this exercise do? And this modality, what's going on here? And so then I went from, you know, my plan was I was going to be a endocrinologist and I was going to cure diabetes. That was my goal. But then I really discovered sports medicine and learned how physicians work in that space. And so I ended up changing my major to kinesiology, and probably the best decision I've ever made. I love what I do. My background is family medicine, was my residency training, and then I did a sports medicine fellowship afterwards. What's great about sports medicine, big umbrella, it encompasses a lot of topics. And so there's always an opportunity to have like a niche within that. And as I'd been in practice for a few years out of training, there was an interest in our orthopedic department about enhancing our bone health initiative to reduce fracture rates, improve care for our osteoporosis patients, especially those who had undergone fracture. And as a family doc, I of course knew some about osteoporosis, but I would hardly have considered myself an expert. So I identified some great mentors and really dove in feet first, learned a lot. And then now I have become kind of the go-to bone health person for our university. And I get a lot of referrals, not only for your traditional osteoporotic patients who have had a hip or a wrist fracture, but I end up seeing a lot of our, you know, ballet dancers, distance runners, and then as well as weekend warriors and triathletes and marathoners in the community who get referred to me after they've had stress fractures to identify any major issues and see what we can do to prevent future injury.
That is quite the path. It's always so fascinating to hear how people start out on a particular path. And then as they follow the things that they're passionate in, their journey evolves into something completely different than what they imagined. So it's wonderful how you ended up where you are. Can you, Dr. Woldridge, can you give us a quick rundown of the full picture of bone health and how it evolves over the course of our lives?
Sure. So it has to do with where we are in our growth cycles, right? So when you are, you know, from babyhood, from infancy onward until you're hitting like your late teens, early 20s, you're in growth mode, right? So what I explain to my patients, we have this balance of bone breakdown and bone building. And when you are, you know, an infant until you hit skeletal maturity, probably in your early to mid 20s, technically, you are just in growth mode. So very little bone breakdown, lots of bone growing. Once you hit skeletal maturity, you have this nice balance of bone breakdown and bone building. And then for women, when they hit menopause, or in men, a little bit later, average age, maybe about 70, what'll happen is you get that shift where there's more bone breakdown than there is bone building. And what happens is you end up getting kind of thinner bone that is more vulnerable to fracture. And we call that spectrum, there's osteopenia or low bone mass. And then it gets to a certain point where it's actually osteoporosis. But the way that this impacts our athletes is our bone is always in flux. So I think people can sometimes make the mistake of thinking that bone is a static organ, state of turnover, damage is being removed, a new bone is laid down. And if you are allowing yourself to have adequate nutrition, adequate rest, and a variety of exercise, that balance is favorable. But if we're not getting enough nutrition, if we are not allowing enough rest, or perhaps if we're doing the same exercise over and over, we don't allow for healing of the damaged tissue. And then that can accumulate and lead to stress injury.
Right. Okay. That was a great overview. Thank you for that. What are some of the common injury concerns that endurance athletes and triathletes included in that might actually be prone to?
Of course, bone stress injuries or stress reactions or stress fractures, which will obviously be a big part of our talk today. But I see various issues, especially I can sometimes see shoulder pain, like chronic shoulder pain, like shoulder impingement or tendonitis during mostly the swimming portion. So we'll notice that, of course. You can, of course, sometimes see a little bit of wear and tear with time as people continue to participate in sports throughout the course of their life. You start, you know, acquiring a little arthritis, and that is nothing to do with the sport. It has to do with genetics. But sometimes it'll start to bother you a little bit more. I see a lot of more overuse stuff. I mean, the only time I've really seen any acute injuries are they typically have to do with a fall off a bike, unfortunately, which does happen. So, you know, concussions, fractures, that kind of thing. But I would say our biggest concerns are going to be our overuse injuries and bone stress injuries are included in that.
Yeah. And Krista, do you have anything to add in that front?
No, not really. Usually it's the same type of injuries, and you're just part of that overall care team that helps them return. So a lot of the work that I did when I was younger was looking at the interaction between like biomechanics and the potential for the overuse injury, especially in elite athletes, and then also just screening for REDS. And helping athletes understand how can we use nutrition to help prevent recurring stress reactions or stress fractures? Like, what's the actual cause of it? Is it nutritional? Is it biomechanical? So that's usually where someone like myself steps into the picture once they've seen the medical physician to help try and prevent it from showing back up again.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That makes complete sense. Dr. Wooldridge, can you tell us what bone density is and what methods are available to assess bone health in the first place?
Sure. So bone density is basically how much bone you have per either centimeter squared or centimeter cubed, if you're looking at aerial versus volumetric. So it's just about how much bone tissue is there. As we age, as mentioned, our bone density, once we're kind of entering menopause age or getting a little bit older, our bone density will tend to start to wane a little bit. And that's because as we get that imbalance of bone breakdown and bone building, that's precisely what happens. The ways that we have of measuring bone density, our gold standard, is going to be through a machine called a DEXA, which is dual X-ray absorptiometry. DEXA primarily looks at the lumbar spine, so the lower back, as well as the hips. You can also get forearm DEXA, which is valuable in certain populations, or then in our spinal cord injury patients, we look at the distal femur. But most people were looking at the hips and the spine. Those are the sites that have been validated. There are some other ways of doing it as well. Sometimes at some of these health screenings or health fairs, you may see people doing ultrasound on the heel, which is pretty good for ruling out osteoporosis, but not if it's really normal, you know that they're going to be fine. But sometimes you have this big gray area where someone could actually, you know, be osteoporotic, but the ultrasound is not really suggestive. There has been an increased interest in the use of CT scan. We get a lot of patients that have CT abdomen and pelvis, and you can actually estimate their bone density at the lumbar spine using that, or there's special kinds of CT technology that we can actually look at the bone density of the hips, the spine, using the special software add-on. So definitely a lot of different ways, but probably the most validated is your standard DEXA.
Okay. And for the DEXA scan, are there any risks involved in having one of these scans in terms of like the radiation that might be present for that scan?
Sure. Minimal risk. So obviously we don't want to do DEXAs on pregnant women, especially because well, there's a fetus overlying that part of the spine when they get large enough. So you're not really getting their spine. But really, there's what's kind of cool about it is there's so little radiation that is involved with it. So in fact, the DEXA technologists don't even have to wear lead aprons the way that X-ray techs do. And the room that the DEXA machine is in does not even have to be lead lined, because as soon as you're about 3 feet away from the machine, the radiation exposure is like background radiation, like what it, like you're not around the machine. So incredibly minute amounts of radiation. So it's roughly the same amount of radiation that you be exposed to just with a day of living on planet Earth. So very, very, very little radiation exposure whatsoever.
We do swimming, we do biking, we do running. And I'm wondering if these three sports affect our bodies in different ways. Do they stress our bones differently, or is it all a similar type of load? Jillian, let's go to you.
They do stress the bodies. They do stress the bodies in different ways, right? So we'll start with running. You think about just the mechanical impact of landing, and that's where a lot of our stress injuries tend to occur, especially for athletes who are a little bit more like quad and calf dominant runners, where they tend to be kind of a bouncy runner or a loud runner. They'll usually get more like increased ground reaction forces when they land. And so that's getting absorbed by your skeleton. And that's where a lot of your stress injuries can occur. When we think about swimming, probably more than anything, it gets your shoulders, especially if you have any shoulder instability, or maybe any upper back, like periscapular, like muscle weakness or underdevelopment. It can cause a little bit of stress there. And then with cycling, I find probably some of the biggest issues are patients from being in that bent forward position for a prolonged time. Sometimes their backs can start to bother them a little bit. Sometimes they'll get nerve irritation and the perineal nerve and the pudendal nerve from the compression of the bike seat. Sometimes some hip pain if they've got any underlying hip impingement, but that's typically what I see in the clinic.
And do any of these sports help to preserve more of the bone health that we might see? So if we have some kind of loss in bone density as we age, are any of these sports going to help us to maintain the level that we have?
So the TLDR version of that answer is probably not really, but it doesn't mean that these are bad sports. So probably the most effective bone preserving exercises are going to be weight training and plyometric training. So whenever you are applying a load across the joint or the bone through the muscle with weight training, it actually helps preserve bone density. And then when you are engaging, especially in multi-directional, moderate to high impact exercise, that is probably some of the most osteogenic or bone building kind of exercise that you can engage in. So when you think about your box jumps, jumping rope, that kind of thing can actually be great, especially because you're waking up your bone's mechanoreceptors. So your bone has these little receptors in it that sense shearing forces. They sense directionality as well as impact. And because our bodies are really good at surviving, I mean, we've survived as a species for 20,000 years by prioritizing where we put our energy. And our bodies like to see new activity because it's going to pay attention to that. So with distance running, for example, after about 20 loading cycles, you lose about 80% of your mechanosensitivity. So you're basically what happens is as you're going on your long run, your bone cells get to the point where they think, you know what? I've seen this before. All we're doing is running in a straight line on a flat surface. I'm not going to waste my energy or resources to repair damage from this. And that's actually how we can get stress fractures or stress reactions. Meanwhile, if you incorporate plyometrics into your training, you're doing some box jumps, you're doing some agility type training, because it's multiple directions, your bones are like, well, wait a minute, whoa, 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 this is new. We actually have to pay attention to this and dedicate resources to recover from this activity. Now, that does not mean swimming is bad for your bones. It does not mean cycling is bad for your bones. It does not mean running is bad for your bones. But it does mean that only doing any one of those specific exercises is probably not going to help you in the long run when it comes to your bone health.
Okay. Now, Krista, I have a question for you specifically because of your background in strength training. How much of this plyometric activity do we have to do to retain the mechanosensitivity of the bones so that we're constantly utilizing them and allowing them to retain that the bone structure and density.
So one of the things that Jillian highlighted was the need to apply a novel or new load to that bone. Okay, so that's a lot of what she's talking about. So even if you go into the weight room and you do plyometrics, you do strength training, if you're never truly kind of shocking those receptors, I guess you would say, with something new and novel or giving it proper rest recovery cycles, it's not going to know that you're actually doing anything for it, I guess you could say. So what we try to do is to develop, at least 2 to 3 times a week, a novel plyometric strength based program for triathletes that actually kind of shock those receptors. So sometimes it's not as much about volume, but it's about introducing something new that causes them to wake up in the face of it. So at least 2 to 3 times a week going into the weight room and incorporating the heavy resistance training and the plyometrics will get you the results you need. The biggest mistake people make is going back and doing the same thing over and over again, okay? So new, novel, same with applying a training load. When you train for triathlon, you need it to be new and novel. If you keep doing the same thing over and over again, you're not going to get the results. So even then, you can start to cause those mechanoreceptors to respond. But if you're not changing up the way you train, you're not going to get the response out of them. So that's the biggest key to getting them to respond. And that's hard. The better you get, the more kind of monotonous endurance training can become, and the less likely they are to kind of be awake. Okay. So the key is to make sure that the variety in training is there and the chronic load is there as well. And just obviously being smart about it, that you don't overstress those receptors, because then you can have a negative reaction as well. So
that makes total sense. So I'm thinking, if you're saying we need to be doing these activities 2 to 3 times a week, is it fair to say that if we were to add in 5 minutes of a different type of plyometric activity to each of our strength workouts, would that be sufficient? Or is it something we have to spend more time on when we're in the gym?
Well, I would suggest a progressive warm-up that wakes up those receptors and then increases in intensity over probably about a 15-minute period of time. So that's typically what most strength coaches would allow for the warm-up, because you don't want to just start doing it, right? Because then you're going to run the risk of like ligament injuries, landing inappropriately. So typically what most strength and conditioning coaches do is they warm you up gently for a few minutes, move you into different planes of motion through like a dynamic warm-up. They start to use an agility ladder. Then they start to have you do a little bounding out there on the, you know, either a grass surface or some type of a softer surface. We don't want to use a hard one. And then they might move you into something more advanced, like a small box jump. Or if you're a little bit older, we take a jump rope and we do kind of have you mix it up. And that's where we might use duration a little bit more to wake those receptors up than you would with a younger athlete that is maybe a little bit safer to do the more advanced plyometrics. So it's all about how do you kind of load those receptors and wake them back up. Now, what we hope is that when you're young, you actually build some really good bone density so that as you do get older and we can't necessarily do the more advanced plyometrics or workouts, that you have bone density to rely on and you can use nutrition to help maintain it as best possible. So that's really the goal over like the course of a lifetime.
And one thing that I definitely want to add with that, and I know this is obviously focusing with our triathletes, but one thing I want to add, especially for maybe the parents who may be listening and have kids that are in sports, you will never accrue as much bone in a concentrated amount of time as you do between about the ages of 10 to 14, 10 to 15. So it really does represent a once in a lifetime opportunity to build a strong, healthy skeleton for the rest of your life. So getting kids up and active, having good nutrition and doing a variety of sports really serves them well, not only in the short term, but in the long term.
That's really important to highlight for a lot of athletes and a lot of triathletes. A lot of us have kids, so it's important for us to be able to know that information. And now, something you had mentioned earlier, both of you have mentioned earlier, is that there is this really important aspect about training, which sometimes we neglect because we're so busy, and it is recovery. So in terms of the injuries and conditions that we've talked about, is there something that you recommend to athletes to promote optimal recovery for the types of injuries that we might sustain as an endurance athlete. Jillian, what do you think about this one?
So a couple of things that I recommend. Getting sleep is very important. A lack of sleep will cause your body to produce more cortisol, and cortisol actually stimulates osteoclasts, which are bone breakdown cells. So it can actually have a negative impact on your bone health. If your body is under a constant state of stress from sleep deprivation. And then of course, nutrition is so important, right? You can't build a house without bricks, or without other materials. So, you need to have adequate nutrition. You need to have adequate rest. You need to have adequate sleep in order to be successful.
So in terms of recovery, Dr. Austin, you have an extensive background in nutrition. Is there anything that we can do for recovery in terms of our nutrition?
Recovery starts before training begins. And there's some good research out there, Vanessa, with regards to how carbohydrate and calcium prior to training helps maintain actual bone metabolism, mainly because it can keep serum calcium levels higher. And that's their understanding. They get a reduction in what's called parathyroid hormone, okay, when they do this. So with athletes who maybe have a propensity towards stress fractures or reactions, or maybe have lower bone density, I do try to use a concept of nutrient timing to help support the bone as they go through training. And then also a lot of times with athletes, the cortisol response is really important because those osteoclasts, you know, do respond to cortisol. And so we get up in the morning and our cortisol is in a normative range. And then all of a sudden, if we have not fueled our bodies, especially with maybe a 10 to 12 hour break between dinner and breakfast, we can actually elevate cortisol to a point, if we don't have carbohydrates prior to an extent that it becomes very negative and detrimental throughout the day. So we try to use nutrient timing to help keep cortisol under control, to help take care of the bone, really, and prevent injury, to help facilitate recovery early on. So like with one of my collegiate athletes, I took a good look at her nutrient timing. What was she having prior to her morning runs and then immediately post? Well, what we saw was that she actually had a deficit in carbohydrate very early on in the day, yet she was training in the morning. So we actually took her carbohydrates and we moved them to the very front. We also saw that her calcium intake was okay, but it wasn't great. So I said, okay, what are you willing to do to help take care of your bones? So we put about a gram of carbohydrate prior to the run, and then also a gram after the run to help make sure her bones were being taken care of. Same thing with calcium. Because it's a little hard to run on a stomach filled with some yogurt or what have you, we do take a calcium chew called Caltrate, and we just give it to them prior to running to help elevate the calcium level. But then post, we say, okay, we want to start that refueling process with protein and carbohydrate. So we might just have something like a Greek yogurt. There's some good 20 gram protein Greek yogurts out there right now. And so I encourage them to have that before they then go to the cafeteria and really start the energy repletion process. So we want to try and get as many calories as possible in those windows so their body is not chronically wearing down. The other thing I try to teach them that, you know, kind of science behind it, is that when you elevate cortisol, you actually impair the ability of your thyroid to function. And the thyroid is very important with regards to vitamin D metabolism. Okay. So if we don't take care of cortisol, it has this kind of domino effect within the entire endocrine system that will help, that really hurts bone density and bone health if you don't control it, if that makes sense. So we try to use nutrient timing to help control that endocrine response as best possible and support bone health. So if you're trying to make sure that you're recovering well, you need to do that continuously throughout the day to keep cortisol under control, to make sure that you are taking in the calcium and vitamin D that you do need to help supplement what you're getting from the sun.
Okay, so I've been noticing, Krista, in some of the workout supplements that I have in my cupboard, with just looking at the labels, there are some of them that actually contain a large amount of calcium and magnesium, and they are coined as during workout supplements. Is that why there's so much calcium? I'm curious as to why there was calcium and magnesium in there. And I'm just thinking this might have to do with it.
Yeah, so there's a couple reasons they may do that. One is that they know that athletes' diets can be deficient in calcium. So calcium, they may be trying to help the bone. It's also a very popular filler in those products when they're developing them. So they might just go ahead and use it regardless without intent. The other thing is with magnesium, they know that athletes struggle to get enough magnesium in the diet if they aren't really dialed in. But also you have to be cognizant that supplement companies sometimes just do it for a branding or marketing perspective.
I just want to circle back to one other thing that you had mentioned earlier about the nutrient timing. And I'm wondering, does this nutrient timing and the quantity of the nutrients are required, does it differ between males and females?
It does, in the sense that energy expenditure is oftentimes different enough that they need to have more as males than they do as females. Okay. So I think the guys sometimes have a bigger job to do, but they're also a little bit heavier. But you're talking about 200 to 300 calories at any one point in time, usually, not, you know, 500 to 1,000. I would just say go by the recommendations of grams per kilogram of body weight for carbohydrates, and know that every 2 to 3 hours, you need about 20 to 25 grams of protein, good quality protein, to help maintain muscle protein synthesis. And they show that if athletes actually follow these guidelines, they'll end up being leaner. They have healthier, you know, profiles. When we take a look at blood chemistry, we take a look at bone density. Those are ones that are doing really well. So oftentimes it's just about following the guidelines. We do it per kilogram of body weight to make sure that it matches the overall all size of the individual.
Jillian, did you have something that you wanted to add in there?
Yeah, just about calcium. So I'm a big believer in food as medicine. So you will very rarely hear me really endorse a lot of supplements, unless somebody like really is struggling getting it from the diet. So when it comes to calcium, we joke that calcium is a Goldilocks nutrient. You can have too much, too little, and just right. And so I definitely caution people on going overboard with calcium, only because it can have a detrimental effect. And so you can absolutely have too much of a good thing. So always being mindful of that. And we know that, again, the dietary sources are always going to be preferred because of the way that you absorb it is more natural for your body, and it's easier for your body to recover from. But of course, supplements absolutely have a role if there is difficulty in doing that. For instance, you don't want something that's heavy on the stomach right before an endurance training bout. That's incredibly uncomfortable. Or if there's certain patients who have undergone, you know, like bariatric surgeries for weight loss or something, so they need lifelong supplementation of certain nutrients. So, but again, I'm a big believer that food is medicine.
Yeah, I fully agree with you on that one. I'm sure Dr. Austin does as well. Now, I'm just really curious. I've always wondered this in terms of the calcium absorption, because we know that calcium is absorbed better as a food source than as a supplement. And does that have anything to do with the type of calcium that is present in the supplement? Like, is that less likely to be absorbed within the body?
It kind of depends. So the calcium primarily comes in three different variations in supplement forms. The most common ones are going to be calcium carbonate, calcium citrate, and tricalcium phosphate. So calcium citrate is generally best absorbed, because calcium is best absorbed when there's a little bit of acid around. If you're going to do a calcium citrate supplement, it's generally pretty well absorbed, because that citrate in there is going to help it be better absorbed by the system. And so you don't have to take it with food. It can be taken on an empty stomach. The downside of that is calcium citrate is a much larger molecule. So usually it's 2 tablets to get the amount of calcium it says on the bottle. And then additionally, it tends to be a little bit more expensive. Calcium carbonate is less expensive. Typically, it's a little bit of a smaller molecule, so it's only like one tablet to get what it says on the bottle. But because carbonate is more of a base, it's not as well absorbed. So it really needs to be taken with a meal if calcium carbonate is going to be the preferred. I find that one also tends to cause more GI distress, causes some constipation and stomach upset. But taken with food, it's best absorbed. Tricalcium phosphate is typically what is found in your gummy calcium formulations. So if you ever get somebody that does like any of the gummies, that one I don't really have much of a problem with. I just caution people with kidney disease, if they're going to be on a calcium supplement, they're already a little bit high in phosphorus. I try not to recommend a lot of tricalcium phosphate. But if someone tends to run a little bit lower on their phosphorus levels, then maybe it's beneficial.
If you're going to take a supplement, make sure you've had a nutrient analysis done prior to kind of going down that road. Okay. Very few athletes have a need for anything more than about 50% of the RDA to be added in via a dietary supplement. So if you're already rich in the micronutrient and you're not having any medical issues that may be related to it, then you need to go ahead and just place the supplement aside. Conversely, sometimes what does happen in athletes is that they get to eat a lot of great food, and maybe the quality that's there is not always 100% of what they might need. Okay. Or we have a circumstance where people are prone to injury, so we increase the demand, or they just, you know, aren't great at getting it into the diet.
I think we need to backtrack just a little bit, because we talked about supplementation before we actually talked about nutrition itself. And Christy, you've done so much work in the nutrition field. Can you tell us what sources of food these nutrients we're going to, sorry, I need to rephrase that. Can you tell us what source of food we're going to be able to get these nutrients from that are so important for bone health? And what do we need to be eating regularly to make sure that we're hitting these targets, especially if we're requiring, as you said, 150% of the RDA for, I'm not even sure if it's just calcium, if there's other nutrients that we need to have for bone health. How can you help us to get what we need, Krista? Tell us.
Okay. Well, this may sound like a generic answer, but it's a highly diversified diet pulling from all the major food groups, because bone is not just a function of calcium. It's a function of a lot of other micronutrients, from vitamin K to choline to biotin to just protein, manganese, you name it, it's helping with bone formation, as is energy density. Okay, so the biggest thing we can do for athletes is to help them actually pull from all the food groups to create really nutritious meals throughout the day that represent everything, and make sure they're just not leaving something out accidentally. Or if they have a specific nutrition approach that we're helping them meet those needs with the type of foods that they require. So sometimes some of the most challenging might be, you know, a vegan diet, okay, or people who do not want to take in calcium products. So that's where we probably have to work a little bit harder to make sure that we have all of those nutrients in there. And you may see a little bit more of a need for supplementation if calorie density is not high enough. So if they're doing triathlon and they're maybe a vegan, and we do want to really try to work to maintain their bones, sometimes calorie intakes at around 2,000 for a vegan present a little bit of a challenge to work with on a day-to-day basis. So that's where food charting or nutrition plans really have to be, I would say, worked on more intensively so that we get as much as possible from food. Now, here's the one that I'm going to kind of throw a loop in for you on this, Vanessa, and that is the role of vitamin D. This is what's really interesting to me when people come in and they think they're going to get the majority of their vitamin D from food. Can we get vitamin D from food? Yes, we can a little bit. But at the end of the day, when doctors tell you to go outside and get some sunshine, some UVB light, just know that they're doing so because most of our vitamin D comes from our eyes. Okay, that's where we absorb it the best. We also absorb it in our skin. And the challenging thing about athletes is that they go, oh my gosh, I'm getting too much sun. I don't want sun, you know, I don't want cancer, right? So they go and they lather up with their sunblock. They put their sunglasses on. And then they go down the road and they're like, why is my vitamin D low? I just don't know why. Well, maybe we got to start to warm up, you know, for at least 15 to 30 minutes and get some sunshine in and then put our sunblock on. Then put the shades on, right? Okay. Because vitamin D is actually stored in our adipose tissue. Okay. And when we exercise, we induce lipolysis, where we release, you know, energy from fat stores in essence. And what they have shown is that with endurance exercise, if you have someone who's not doing it and then you train them to a certain level, they'll actually increase their serum vitamin D because they might have been taking it in, but they weren't releasing it. Okay. So when you take a look at vitamin D stores, you actually have to be pretty careful, in my opinion, because not only is it environment, but it's also epigenetic factors that we have to take a look at and say, okay, what might be kind of manipulating the value that we see in front of us? And that's where our food matters, our supplementation matters if we really need it. Okay. And that's when we start to move down that road and saying, how much do we need to get from food or can we get from food? And then also, you know, how high do we get those vitamin D stores? And I know that's kind of a, you know, area where endocrinologists talk a good bit about what are those stores? How do we supplement? When do we need to supplement? And I think it's kind of something that is a chronic state of debate. If we are in a state of sufficiency, is anything more than the RDA needed? Even if our bodies, they say, are using far more than what the RDA is giving us from food, okay? So just kind of be cognizant that not everything comes from food itself. We do want you to get out there and get some sunshine without your sunglasses on.
Vitamin D is the one time you'll hear me say it's probably better to get it from a pill. Just because I've seen some gnarly cases of skin cancer. So I over the course of a lifetime, that sun damage accumulates. I have some good friends who are dermatologists. And so that's the one time I'll say, I will probably recommend someone get it from a pill, only because I think it's sometimes a little bit easier to manipulate, especially in the South, in Texas, you know, during those high sunshine parts of the day, it's so exquisitely hot that it's miserable to be outside. And so then I worry about risks of other things. So that's the one time I will usually recommend getting it from a pill. But vitamin D absolutely can come from, you know, synthesis from sun exposure. They've actually done some research on like on Hawaiian surfers that spend all day without any sunscreen. And I think their vitamin D levels end up naturally topping out around 70. That's where they kind of like reach their maximum and their body's like, that's enough. And, but I usually aim for a level of about 40 to 60 nanograms per deciliter is usually my goal for my bone health.
I think we're going to shift completely. We're going to do a total 180 in terms of where we're going with this. Cause this is the question that I've been dying to hear your answer for. And I really want to know about hormone levels and how they influence bone health. And especially, is there a difference between females and males and the effects of these hormone levels on those, on that population? So Jillian, please talk to us about hormone levels and bone health.
Sure. So the most important hormone for both men and women for bone health is estrogen. So women are at increased risk of stress injuries compared to men. A lot of that honestly is probably from bone size. Men tend to have larger bones, and so it's going to be more resistant to injuries. But for both men and women, it's actually estrogen. So, and for a lot of people, they may say, well, that's crazy because men have testosterone. Well, it gets aromatized or it gets converted to estrogen, and that's actually what protects the skeleton. So all men should have some degree of estrogen that is present, and that's actually what helps them preserve their bones. So whether it's a male or female athlete are in a nutrient balance state. So they are, yes, they are exercising, but they are getting the sufficient rest and the sufficient nutrients to support their activity level. They're in a nice state of homeostasis. They're getting the hormones that they need to support their skeleton. However, when there's an imbalance there, you know, it could be that they're, you know, not getting the rest that they need, they're exercising too much, or they're not fueling enough for their exercise. Their bodies, as I mentioned earlier, we are meant to survive. And what that means is that your body will prioritize your brain and your heart above everything else. So it will do everything it can, including dissolve your skeleton and eat away at your own muscle in order to produce energy for your brain and your heart to continue going. So whenever you are in, you know, kind of starvation mode or preservation mode, your body does not care about producing happy hormones, your dopamine, your serotonin, your norepinephrine. It's not going to prioritize using different substrate, I guess, in your body to actually produce those. It will also not bother with producing sex hormones like your estrogen, your testosterone. So when you end up in that energy deficient state, your body is just not going to waste the energy. And that's why, especially for our endurance athletes or other, particularly our female athletes, we'll notice their periods start to get lighter or go away altogether. That is a big, big red flag. There used to be a school of thought, that means you're training hard enough, but we know that that is a big flashing neon sign that we have a problem if your periods are going away. Because if your body is not producing enough estrogen to maintain a menstrual cycle, it is certainly not producing enough estrogen to maintain your skeleton, and you are at substantially increased risk for having poor bone density and developing not only bone stress injuries, but other injuries. The way this translates over into the male population is if you are, you know, so lean, you have such little body fat that your testosterone is not being aromatized into estrogen, it may also have a negative impact on your bone health. And you may experience, and you can also get drops in testosterone, of course. You can experience things like, you know, decreased libido, erectile dysfunction. I mean, things like that, that just don't improve your quality of life. So being sufficient in energy consumption and balancing that with your energy utilization to maintain your sex hormones is such an important part of your bone health.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Thank you for bringing that up. So you had talked about the red flags in terms of hormone levels and how they affect the body. Are there any other red flags that might indicate an athlete is developing a bone-related issue?
Obviously, I mean, pain, right? So one of the biggest things is you get that pain with activity that gets better when you rest, probably takes about 30 minutes or so to feel better. Or, you know, you don't feel as bad, maybe shin pain or something early in the day, but as you're going on, you're getting that deep aching pain that worsens with activity and gets better when you sit down. That's something you need to pay attention to. Having a hard time recovering from other injury, I think, is also a big issue. So, you know, you're getting those chronic overuse injuries that are just lingering around, right? And again, this can be multifactorial. It can be from doing the same activity over and over, or it can be from just not getting what you need in order to recover from that well. Having excessive, you know, fatigue, just feeling kind of worn out all the time. Those are probably our little neon signs that say, hey, there's an issue here, right? And we always want to intervene on that sooner rather than later, because it's basically that we don't have as deep of a hole to get ourselves out of. So I always lean towards intervening as soon as possible, because even if we do have a male or a female athlete with something like REDS, sometimes all it takes is about 250 or so calories a day to get your periods back. That's a Snickers bar, you know? So it's sometimes it's actually not that hard to get it back, but the deeper you've dug yourself into that hole, the harder it's going to be to get out of. So identifying your treatment team and identifying your support system during this time of training is so important, so you can have somebody intervene sooner rather than later.
And that is a perfect segue into my last question that I have for today. So how do you suggest that someone finds a good practitioner who can help them get back on track towards optimal bone health? I think that this is a huge barrier for a lot of people, is knowing that they have an issue, but then not knowing who to actually seek out to help them overcome this issue. So what kind of recommendation do you have for that?
From a like medical care physician standpoint, through two of the sports organizations that I'm a member of, the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine and the American Osteopathic Academy of Sports Medicine, both of those websites actually have like a find a doc link through their website where you can actually look by zip code, by city, and you can find where we have members there, where we have board certified sports medicine specialists. Not everybody, the sports med world is just like any other medical specialty where maybe not every single person is going to do this. But we certainly all have training in it. And you can at least get resources to be directed to someone who can help you. And so, for the United States, we've got that. We have sports medicine colleagues in Canada, although I confess that I don't know as much about the Canadian Sports Medicine Society's website and what it has to offer. But that's at least something from like a pure, physician standpoint of finding somebody who can help get you the support you need.
Yeah. And for those who are in the Houston area, how can they get connected with you?
Sure. So in order to reach me, I just tell people calling our office is the easiest way to get an appointment with me. So our phone number is 713-441-9000. I do a lot of this. I have a lot of patients with disordered eating and full-on eating disorders that I manage as well. Some of the red stuff, whether it's some intentional or unintentional restricting. So I tend to do a lot of this. I also have some patients that just seek me out for like dietary and exercise counseling in general. And if it's something that I think they need a lot more fine-tuned advice from what I can offer, I'm really lucky to be in a city the size of Houston where I've got some wonderful sports dietitians that I know, sports psychologists that I know. And there's some of our hospital systems in the city actually do the really intense analysis. They're actually going through and doing the full metabolic analysis, like resting metabolic rate, basal metabolic rate, VO2 max testing for those people who really want to optimize those kind of higher level elite folks. So I'm lucky to be in a very resource rich area.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
It's Coach Cooldown Tip Time, and I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. We are all in for a treat today with our next guest. TriDot coach Ben Somerville is in the house. Ben is a member of the Precision coaching team over in the UK and has quite the triathlon resume. He is a former elite junior triathlete, has represented Great Britain as an age grouper at Worlds and European Championships. He has 8 national championship medals and is a 2-time national champion. Coach Ben accomplished all of this over 10 years and has since progressed to coaching as a way of giving back to the community by helping others improve their physical and mental health and well-being through triathlon. He specializes in intermediate to elite level triathletes who have an interest in sprint and Olympic distance races. Not only is he a rock star triathlete and coach, he rounds out his knowledge base working full-time for a sports collagen recovery nutrition supplement brand, where he supports people to optimize their recovery to drive better performance. Welcome to the show, Coach Ben.
Thank you so much for having me. It is an absolute pleasure.
All righty. Now, I hear that you are a wee bit superstitious and that you will always put your right sock on before the left. So where on earth did this superstition come from?
Oh, I was hoping no one would find out about that one, but the secret has let slip. I would like to say it's got a really interesting and fascinating background, but I think at the root of it is quite literally because I'm right-handed, so I write with my right hand. I do most things with my right hand, and I think it's a force of habit. But then in the process of becoming a more accomplished triathlete, I think in those little minute processes, the act of using the right hand, the left hand to put my socks on in the morning before I go to a race, 4 o'clock in the morning before a race start. It's those little things in my mind that make all the difference. And it starts with a good pair of socks. The more outrageous, the more stripes, the more spots, the brightest colors. I love a good funky pair of socks. And it all starts with the right one and then to the left.
I love that. I also have a very fond love for crazy socks, but it doesn't just end at the socks. It carries on throughout the entire outfit. So the crazier, the better. That's great. So I have a feeling that this superstition that you have may lend into your tip that you have for us. So what can you tell us today about your tip for your athletes?
So my primary tip, the most important thing that I won't take credit for myself, it is something that I merely pass on to the people I come into contact with. And it's less of a tip and it's more of a coaching point, and that it's success is not a chance event. And this comes from a wonderful colleague of mine, Professor Greg White, based here in the UK, an Olympian and sports scientist and an ultra endurance specialist. So all credit to him, not to me, for this amazing saying. And it's all about those little things that make the biggest difference. It's about all the things you can optimize in your lifestyle, in the environment around you, the right equipment, the right coaching, just the right nutrition, the right quality of sleep, the right training. All of those things equal proper preparation, planning. It drives your passion. It drives your enthusiasm, your discipline. And that's where success comes from. Success just doesn't happen because you say one day I'm a triathlete and I'm going to achieve my triathlon goal. It's a combination of all the small things you do every single day, every single week, doing the right training right with all the right support around you and the right enthusiasm, people who are equally invested in your progress and your journey as you are. That's why success is not a chance event.
I love that you said that. One of the things that you had mentioned is that it's all of these little things that you do that will culminate to success. But not only do you do those little things on a daily basis, but it's the consistency of doing those things every day for a long period of time that is going to breed that success.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you look at the primary determinants of endurance performance, endurance progression, The nature of the training comes second to just consistency, doing something consistently right, consistently well, drives better performance than the variety or the actual minutiae of the training that you're doing. The plan is important, but if you can just do something consistently that works for you, keeps you motivated, fits into your life, it adds to your life rather than subtracts from the rest of your life, do that consistently. And then you'll achieve your goals, then you'll achieve your success, whatever that means to you, because obviously everybody's definition of success will be completely different.
I love that very much. Everybody's definition of success will be completely different. That is so spot on, because some people are in this sport to, you know, improve their lifestyle or to be a role model for their children or, you know, maybe it's to be on the podium. So I love that having that success is a unique circumstance for every single person.
Absolutely. You know, and it's part of the process is identifying what that will mean to you. And I'm working with a good coach, working in a club environment, though we're in a very individual sport. If you find those right people to inspire you, you'll find what success means to you. As daunting as it may seem on the outside, you'll find it very quickly and you'll find it very, very engaging. And just speaking from experience, this sport changed my life and I see it change the lives of countless other people when they just recognize the benefit it can have for both their physical and mental health.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.